Dog Works Training Centers, professional dog training in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, presents Mush You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush You Huskies is part of Twine Group Media and is syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Gordo.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and we are covering the 2011 Iditarod, and we do have a winner. But before we get to talk about John Baker and bringing up my co-host, I want to give a shout-out to the new intro that we finally got. I put that request in over a month ago, and it just so happened that we got it the last day of our coverage on the Iditarod. So at least it's on. We have a new intro for the remainder of the year on Mush You Huskies, but sounds okay to me, but we'll see how it goes. So on the line, I have my co-host who is driving home, so she's in the car. Michelle calling in from Denver. Michelle, how are you?
You know, I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing 68 miles an hour, and I think that's pretty good in Denver traffic.
There you go. And on the other line, we have our Iditarod expert, the author of Ballad of the Northland. You can get it right here on the Blog Talk Radio page as well as all over the internet. Seven-time Iditarod finisher and our expert for the duration of this coverage this year, Jason Barron. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great, Robert. And once again, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on for the last 10, 11 days, and I know you took a lot of time out of your day to do this. You got a budding family and a writing career and everything, so we want to make sure that we give you some props throughout this, and we really appreciate it. And if you're not on the trail next year, maybe we'll have you back. How's that?
Well, that sounds like a pretty fair deal. I'll tell you that this show is actually, and writing on my blog and covering the Iditarod has been kind of a new experience. Well, it's a very new experience for me, and it's helped me exercise some of my frustration. This will be my first year having set out, you know, the pro mushing circuit. I feel like I should be out there with Ramey and John and Hans and those guys, and this has kind of helped me dull the edge. It's been pretty tough on me to watch this race, and talking about it has at least kind of made me feel like I was more connected.
Right, and I remember way back, I don't know, late December, early January, you sent me a Facebook message and said, let's talk a little bit how to start a blog. And I remember you mentioning that, and your blog has just taken off like wildfire. How is the traffic and your readership? I know you produce some great stuff on that on your blog, MrJasonBarron.wordpress.com.
Yeah, well, thank you for the shout-out there. No, it's been great. I got it going December 18th of last year, right before Christmas. And, you know, it started out very modest. I mean, I think my first few days, I think I had 20 or 30 people read it. Nobody knew I had a blog. And then I built it up to, it was probably 300-400 people a day in the middle of the week before the Iditarod. And over the Iditarod, it's really spiked. You know, I think I was getting something to the tune of 2,000 to 3,000 people a day were reading it. And what I would hope, and of course you expect to see something like that. Most of those people are reading it because of the Iditarod coverage. Now, I'm going to keep that blog going. It's something I post to every day, and it isn't always going to be Iditarod stuff. A lot of it's just about my writing and about my own kind of stuff that's going on in my life. But I'm hoping some of those people stay. I mean, I really do hope that people are entertained, like my writing style, see that I provided something different. A lot of number crunchers out there. A lot of people are good with statistics and how to parse the Iditarod. But what I hope I showed people was sort of a different approach and a different sort of literary style and more of an entertainment approach, I think. And I invite all of you who've listened to this program and read my stuff, stick with me. I'm going to be doing this for the foreseeable future, and I plan to keep you entertained.
Well, you know, a friend of mine sent me a message on Twitter this morning, and he said that only 0.6% of everybody that is online writes a blog, and less than half of those people write one every day. So you're in very select company, and I'm very amazed at how well yours is doing, and I want to wish you well with that over the next year. I'm sure you and I will talk as we're going. But speaking of social media, I got in last night at about 4 o'clock in the morning after a heck of a battle trying to get all the Serum Run dogs from the airport back up here to Willow, and finally laid down about 5 o'clock this morning. And what woke me up was a text message from a friend of mine that said, are you watching the television? John Baker is just coming in to Nome, and that's what woke me up this morning, about 9:30, so I slept in a little bit. It's a great way to get woken up. So I turned the TV on real quick, and just as he was pulling in to Nome under the Burled Arch, John Baker wins 2011 Iditarod at about 9:30 or so Alaska time. So let's start with that, Jason. That was a record-breaking pace. He's kind of shattered the records of what Martin Boozer set a few years ago, and even Ramey Smith, who came in second, even beat Boozer's record of 8 days and 22 hours. I believe he did it in about eight. What was it exactly, Ramey Smith?
Well, I'm a little bit confused. I had it figured at 8 days, 19 hours. This is for John. 8 days, 19 hours, and something like 46 minutes. But then when I went and looked at the official standings, it said 8 days, 18 hours, and 46 minutes, and then gave the 8 days, 19 hours, and 46 minutes to Ramey. So whatever the case is, historically, the record for this route and the Iditarod in overall is 8 days, 22 hours, and something like 23 minutes, somewhere between 23 and 46 minutes. I forget exactly, but it was several hours longer, set by Martin Boozer in 2002, and this is a big deal. This is a record that's going to stand for a while. I don't think we're going to see this one get broken anytime soon.
Before we get into our commentary about the winners and what's to come with the next guys that are making their way into Nome, is, you know, you used to hear all the time about the speed record for the 7-minute mile running and all these sorts of things, and the 6-minute mile and so on and so forth. How fast do you think a guy or a gal can run the Iditarod with taking into account the mandatory 24s and the 8-hour layovers that they have to take and those sorts of things? What do you think is the top speed with a team of dogs? I know you've been doing this for your whole life.
Well, yeah, and certainly not as well as these two people who finished first and second. I mean, this is really pretty historic what's happened out here. I mean, it is definitely an evolutionary leap in terms of dog output. You know, I was just kind of going through my career earlier today and just looking at some of my better runs, and just, you know, like, you know, good by the standards of the day that I was in, but nothing compared to what they're doing out there now. I mean, it really is incredible. So I'm you know, you have to take what I say with a grain of salt. I've been very successful, but, you know, my guess is as good as yours. I mean, I look at the GPS readings, and I see drivers who are essentially on flat ground on a hard, fast trail. In other words, it's not punchy. It's just a nice, slick trail. It's a good, solid footing for the dogs. It's easy poling for the runners of the sled. So it's the perfect, fast trail. I also see the perfect conditions. It wasn't too warm. It wasn't too cold. It didn't really ever significantly blow on the drivers, and I mean that in the sense of a storm. It never snowed. It never really did anything, you know, really extreme. It was just this perfect condition. So you know, what we were seeing on a flat trail under perfect conditions, perfect temperatures, with the front runners, was about an 8-mile-an-hour average, 7.9 to 8.5, according to their GPSs. I will say that there is a different approach to the speed, and I'm doing like air quotes here, the speed with which we're seeing the drivers exhibit on this race, and what Martin Boozer did back in 2002, and what Doug Swingley, who was the one sort of before that, who was setting the bar for speed. Those guys were running, Martin and Doug were running slower overall races than we just saw, but much higher rates of speed. They didn't have transponders back in those days, so I don't know this for a positive. But I imagine if we sat down and parsed the numbers and look at run rest schedules, that Doug Swingley running like the southern route, which is this route here I forget what exactly what year it was, but it was 9 days even and then 53 minutes, that he was significantly faster miles per hour than anything we saw from John Baker or Ramey Smith, but took dramatically more rest, so that the whole race came out to, you know, to a different figure. Plus, the mileage was a little bit different. I think it was probably about a 40-mile longer race the year that Doug set that record. And actually, you know what? The record by Martin Boozer was set on the northern route. So I think actually this is not only this is the overall record for the southern route and the and the overall race. But, you know, that's the thing is that right now the way people are running is this crazy kind of long runs, and they aren't really going that fast in the great scheme of things. I mean, 9 miles an hour was a fast time according to the transponders. When Doug Swingley was winning it and when Martin Boozer was at his fastest, they were probably doing more like 10 to 11 miles per hour moving average. It's just they need a lot more rest to do it.
Michelle has a statement to make, but before we do, Jason, do you have any idea how long they were running at the beginning of the Iditarod, you know, the start in the early 70s, how long it took guys?
Well, I think the first, you know, I think my dad, who ran 1979, his first year of actually racing the Iditarod, it took him like 3 weeks to, he was just kind of middle of the pack, 25th, 27th place, and it took him 21 days to get to know him in 1979. And he was considered just, you know, kind of like the equivalent of the drivers who were going to come in tomorrow, you know, just that next kind of wave back.
Right.
So very
right.
long.
Michelle, you had a statement there?
Well, I was just, you know, what I was interested in as far as the times go and the records go, it was right what Jason was saying, that this was set on the southern route, not on the northern route, and Boozer did it on the northern route. And from what I understand, the southern route has a tendency to always have slower times. So, I mean, I think that we can't really compare to, like, Jason's dad, for instance, because the rules were different then, too. I mean, they didn't have as strict of a schedule as far as the mushers got to get through as fast as they do now. I mean, now the rules say, you know, if Baker's 300 miles ahead of the last guy, then the last guy might get a, you know, mandatory scratch because he's not moving along fast enough. So
Jason?
I think that plays a lot into the significance of the time being set.
Sure. Sure. Oh, undoubtedly. You know, the race has changed a lot. And, you know, all we've seen is, you know, the sport is actually in its infancy. And it was certainly, I mean, it's in its infancy now. And in, so 20 years ago, 27 years ago, it was, you know, it was hardly a sport even. It was just like people really didn't know what they were doing. And that's one of the things I cover in Battle of the Northland, is a little bounce back to the book here. Is my book, I actually deal with that time frame back when Joe May and Bud Smith, and they're not in the story, but that time period when my people like my dad were actually the preeminent, you know, sort of figures of that era. And, you know, it was more like a bunch of mountain men and old trappers and gold miners and stuff who happened to have some dog teams, and they got together and they had this trip to Nome. It bore hardly any relationship other than the same trail. It bore hardly any relationship to methodology and, you know, the advancements of dog care and dog, you know, just training philosophy and also the care of the trail. You know, things have changed. It's really hard to compare the Iditarod year to year because the weather does so much to change the trail. It's not like a football game where, you know, you've got AstroTurf or whatever, and that's just what you've got.
Right, right. So now that we have John Baker in first, Ramey Smith in second, Hans Gott is in third in safety, then we have C.V. Neff and Shanouli and Reddington to follow. And you talked last night about Peter Kaiser. He is now in eighth place. So he's moved up quite a few spots since we were on the air last night. So evidently your analysis is paying off, Jason, because whatever you're saying is working right into exactly what's going on. So let's talk a little bit about, before we get into what happens at the end of the race, what's going to happen in the next 24, 48 hours from now?
Well, you know, what's happening out there is pretty significant. I'm going to tie this in with something we talked about a few days ago about teams and dogs not wanting to continue anymore. You know, what happened, and I'm amazed by how many people this didn't happen to based on how hard they were all pushing at the midway, is I made the prediction that there were going to be teams that fall off some kind of dramatically. And one thing I never really got, because of how hard they were pushing, and it may not show up for a few days, and it took so long for it to show up, that we've actually forgotten about these people, but it did, and I'll get into this. But, you know, some of the drivers who were hanging back and running a more conservative strategy, people like Ken Anderson, Jesse Royer, Didi Genreau, Pete Kaiser is the first amongst them. Dallas Eby actually was way out of the picture there for a while. Now he's come roaring back up into the top five. you know, they ran these schedules that said, okay, in effect, let those top drivers go, let Baker, let Ramey, let them kind of do their crazy stuff, and then we will come along and we'll pick up all the broken pieces as most of them will fail, and as they sort of, in the sense that they get to know them as well as they had planned, and then they get to know them, but maybe struggling to do so. And then you get these people like Jesse Royer and Pete Kiser, who essentially are still coming along with teams that are probably moving similar to how they moved out of Willow 10 days ago, and they just go roaring past these weaker teams. Also, we talked about dogs not wanting to continue, and there were a few dramatic examples of this happening. Robert Bunsen sat on, it took him 29 hours. He was one of the front runners early, real hard pusher. He was staying with the pace, driving a really nice dog team. He's an experienced driver. And it took him almost 30 hours to get from Shaktulik to Koyuk, where he pulled in and he scratched. And, you know, most of that time was sitting there in one spot about midway across Horton Sound, which is not a very nice place to be sitting. And, you know, one has to assume, and I know what an assumption makes of us, but, you know, we clearly had problems, and I don't want to act like I have a crystal ball, but it seems pretty reasonable to connect it with how hard he was pushing early in the race and that it caught up with him. Now, there's nothing really surprising about that. Maybe his leaders probably quit. He probably ran out of leaders, dogs who wanted to do it, and they just said, nope, I ain't going to go. And then after about 20, you know, hours of just sitting in one spot, that he kind of got them to go and, you know, limped into the checkpoint of Koyuk. So that's probably certainly connected with how hard he drove earlier in the race. Another person who wasn't driving very hard but still had problems with continuing up the river was a guy named Chris Hoffman from Colorado, who was driving a puppy team, and he ran out of leaders and his dogs wouldn't continue up the river, and he had to turn around and go back to the checkpoint of Grayling. He was the Red Lantern holder, and he had to turn around after spending the same all of last night sitting there on the ice of the Yukon River, had to turn around and go back. Oftentimes, dogs will turn around and go back to a place where they remember there being a checkpoint when they won't continue on. Now, you know, so these are examples of what happens when your runs start to, you know, really dramatically fall apart. And my heart really goes out to these guys, but, you know, to a real limited extent. I mean, this is the risk we all take being in this race, and, you know, a non-completion is just part of the risk that comes along with daring great things.
With that non-completion, we had 62 mushers start in Willow this past Sunday, so about 9 days ago, and 13 guys and gals have scratched, which is about 20% of the field. Is that a typical number for any given year? Is it low or is it high?
Oh, boy. I would say it's a little on the high side. And keep in mind that the you're seeing 62 is the lowest starting number, you know, the lowest starting number that we've seen in quite some time. I mean, the Iditarod's definitely, just like its purse, as the cost of doing this goes up and the purse goes down, you're just going to see this sort of trend where less and less people do it. I mean, there's a lot of top drivers who weren't there this year. You know, I wasn't there. King wasn't there. Ed Eaton's not there. Zach Steer wasn't there. Aaron Burmeister's not there. And I suspect that over the next few years, you could see more drivers, more good ones, kind of sort of hemorrhage out of the roster. What really surprised me about the number of drivers who scratched or withdrawn is, if you look at that roster, it's not just the number. I mean, it's a pretty intimidating number, but it's also the quality of the drivers that were in that group. I mean, Robert Bunsen has run, I don't even know exactly, but he's run more than I have. I mean, he's got to have 10, 12 Iditarod, so, I mean, he's a great driver. Guys like Paul Gebhardt, I mean, he was a guy picked for the, you know, to potentially win. I mean, just a tremendous team, and he comes into Nikolai of all places. I mean, this is like so early, it's the prehistory of the race, and he's basically, his team is just like falling apart, and he has to pull out. You know, I would say that Lance Mackey is lucky that he's going to have a completion, because he's been running with a small team essentially since Ofer, and he's done a masterful job of holding together this little tiny group of dogs while around him there's all these drivers with 12 to 14 or 15 dogs. And if he'd lost any more, he would have been potentially out of the race. So, I mean, it really blows me away by the quality. There was a guy named Mike Santos who pulled into Unalakleet, and this is his first Iditarod. He's a rookie, but he's a very accomplished driver as a, you know, kind of coming into the Iditarod. And, I mean, definitely was one of those, like, sure bets, if there is such a thing, about a rookie doing well and running, you know, finishing in Nome. And he pulled into Unalakleet with 9 dogs, obviously been running out of dogs for, you know, losing dogs throughout the race, and pulled in with 9 dogs and scratched. Again, you know, the rumor was ran out of leaders. So, you know, it's the quality of these people that, you know, there's so many of these good mushers out there that I just, you know, Mitch Seavey cutting his finger off. I mean, it really blows me away, the quality of people on that scratched and withdrawn list.
And before all these guys and gals head back to their jobs, whatever they are, and their primary job of picking up dog poop in a few days, there's going to be a banquet. And I believe that's just in a couple of days, and everybody that's in from the trail can take part of that. What goes on at that banquet?
Let's see. It should be Sunday night. And that's going to give the field, for the most part, the chance to come in. I mean, we'll see some more drivers fall out. I mean, I'm sure we'll see another scratch or two. But for the most part, I think that it's likely that you might have even the very last Red Lantern driver into the checkpoint, of Nome, the finish line. And what goes on there is actually the most fun part of all the festivities that surround the Iditarod. The finishing banquet, well, at least from a driver's standpoint, it's always been my experience, is that it's also, there's so much work involved with preparing for the Iditarod at the beginning that you can't enjoy the festivities. The driver doesn't enjoy being at the banquet, the pre-banquet before the Iditarod starts, because you just have so much on your mind, and it's also just real stuffy. I mean, it's real, you know, they try to make it fun, but basically, you know, you got to get dressed up and parade in front of the public when that's the last thing on your mind. In Nome, the banquet is actually very informal. Everybody's just, they have this like gigantic, I don't know, it's like some sort of huge gymnasium, some sort of arena, and they just bring in like one, it's like a school, like a gigantic school cafeteria. Everyone's just sort of crammed in here on these benches and like school tables, school benches, and it's all a huge, just wonderful, wonderful catered food and lots of it. I mean, it's more than you could possibly eat, and you can just keep going back and forth for more, and it's just, there's this sort of feeling of accomplishment, and this, you know, whether you won or finished fifth or last, you know, it's over. You know, you don't have to worry about it anymore. This race is over. Everybody just shows up very casually. Some people are going to be dressed in a bit, you know, like business attire, fine suits, but some people are going to come walking in their bunny boots and their dog mushing gear because they probably just got done feeding the dogs and cleaning up after them 10 minutes before the banquet started. So it's very, it just has this kind of authentic Alaskan Yukon kind of feel to it, which I think is a real, you know, essential part of the Iditarod experience. And then, you know, you get to listen to the drivers go up there and talk about their races. And not all of them are the best speakers, but most of them will tell a little story and thank their sponsors. And it's kind of the Academy Awards for dog mushers, but just picture most of the people showing up on the red carpet wearing bunny boots and mucklucks.
Is it open to the public, or is it just a Iditarod affair?
Oh, it's open to the public. I mean, you have to buy a ticket. I think it's $35 or $40 to get in, but it's worth it. I mean, anybody listening to this that's up in Nome hasn't decided, buy a ticket. This is, you know, and also this is historic. You know, this is the first Inupiaq Eskimo who's ever won the Iditarod. So not only is the all-time record holder for speed, you know, I mean, there's just one honor after the other going to be heaped on John Baker. Inupiaq, I mean, he's a hero of the people up in the villages and stuff. And there's this is a great thing, a wonderful day for Alaska. So he's, you know, he won the Iditarod. He has the record. He's the first Inupiaq Eskimo to ever win, and then I think he's the first Native Alaskan to actually win it since, boy, I sure hope I don't get called down to the mat on this one, but I don't think anyone's a Native Alaskan's won it since Emmett Peters. So, I mean, quite a span of time has gone by. So, I mean, this is going to be a historic a banquet to be a part of.
Well,
so now...
In the paper, they said that he is the first Northwestern Alaskan to, you know, be able to go through the World Arch. So I think that is significant for the state of Alaska right now with all the, you know, the press that they're getting and all the shows that are going on up there, you know, Alaska State Troopers and all these Sarah Palin shows and stuff. I think that this is a significant plug for Alaska because it's just going to help with tourism and get more people up there checking it out. And, you know, all three of us know how much that state thrives on its tourism. So,
oh, sure. Absolutely. I think John Baker's going to make a good champion. I actually think Sarah Palin was doing a lot for Alaska too, whether everybody recognizes that or not. But John Baker is clearly going to be – he's a man of few words, but he's a class act. I mean, he's not one of your slick talkers at all. I mean, he's not gonna fill up too many 30-minute back-to-back radio shows. Just got to keep it going with the gift of gab. However, what he does have to say is very profound. I mean, he's one of those men that sort of considers what he considers his words very carefully before he lets them out of his mouth. And when he does let them out of his mouth, they usually have some gravity. And you know, his skill and knowledge, and not only is it Musher, but as a man, as an experienced person of the Arctic region, is profound. So I think that, you know, John Baker, I'm pulling for all these guys, but I mean, I went on record. I've been pulling for the little guy. In this battle, David and Goliath kind of battle that was going on, Ramey Smith was David, and he was the little guy, and I grew up with Ramey, and I was pulling for him. So, I mean, I'm just got to be, you know, full disclosure here. But Alaska won regardless of which one of these drivers came in first, and it's just a special thing that's happened. And remember, in the top 10, there's not a single Iditarod champion, you know, until today, that was finishing in the top 10. So it gets to the point where you have these back-to-back champions like Lance Mackey, where it's not necessarily the best thing for the race if that person keeps on stealing all the headlines. So this was, you know, this was a great day for dog mushing. It was just a great experience, and I think it's a little harbinger of what's to come in the future of the Iditarod.
With that, for our last segment here of our Iditarod coverage, Jason, let's talk about the Red Lantern. Why is that so significant in kind of the lure of dog sled racing? Almost every mid-distance and long-distance race has a Red Lantern award, and a lot of people know about this, but they aren't quite sure how to grasp it. What exactly is that, and why is it so mystical to the race fans?
Yeah, well, look, I got to be really honest here, is that as a very ultra competitive musher, I have avoided being at the back of the pack with every fiber of my body. So it's kind of I'm probably not the best person to talk to about the mystique of the Red Lantern, because I've avoided it, like, you know, as well as I could by staying, you know, in front of it. The one experience I had with getting a Red Lantern was in the Junior Iditarod, my very first distance race back in 1986, and I got lost, and I was one of the first people out of the starting chute on Willow Lake, and I got 14 years old. I got lost, and I was lost for 2 or 3 hours. And by the time I got back on the trail, the rest of the kids were, you know, long gone, and you know, I kind of muddled around the race, and as I got to the finish line, I had decided I was going to be not only last but way in last position. And as it turned out, I was running a very strong team. And on the way back from the halfway point towards back to the finish line, it's just a Junior Iditarod just for kids. It's just about an 80-mile run out to a halfway point, a 10-hour mandatory layover. The kids, you know, stand around the campfire and just, you know, camp out and have fun. And then they turn around and they race back to the starting line. The finish line is where the race started. Well, on the way back, I had decided I was for sure going to get last place, but I kept running into snow machiners who would tell me that there's this team in front of me. And every time I talked to a snow machiner on the trail, they would say, well, this team's an hour in front of you. And then I'd go a few miles, I'd see somebody else, and they're, oh, he's 30 minutes in front of you. And eventually I got to the point where I was very close to this driver, and I actually caught them on Willow Lake, coming across Willow Lake, and finished in the chute with them. We were last and next to last, and it was Jason Mackey, Lance's brother. And I actually passed him. My leaders, I went ahead and got around him, and my leaders passed him and put him in the Red Lantern position. But that's my only brush with getting the Red Lantern. But what I would say is that, you know, historically, they call it the widow's lamp as much as it is the Red Lantern. And it's there to sort of symbolize somebody leaving the light on in a pioneer way for the last driver to safely get off the trail. It's a great deal more significant in something like the Iditarod or the Quest, where the nature of the event is so arduous, is so extreme, that we really do worry about the safety of these mushers and their dogs, and especially the ones who've sort of been dropped off the back of the pack. So I think there's sort of this sourdough connection, you know, it's probably a little bit greater than just finishing last place in, say, a middle distance race. And I think that what we're really saying to these drivers is typically someone who comes in last place in the Iditarod isn't some pro it's, you know, someone's trying to be competitive. It's someone who's just trying to survive this race and was just there to be in it and to be a part of it. So they, you know, they're there for their own personal challenge as much as much more than anything else. And it's there to symbolize that they've safely gotten off the trail, and it is an honor to these people. So I definitely don't mean to besmirch that whatsoever. Just that I just don't have the best perspective on it. But it is an honor, and if I race again, who knows? Maybe that's what I'll shoot for.
Well, you know, for a lot of these guys, you know, just finishing is 99% of the battle for some of the, you know, for their entire mushing career. That's what they've set their sights on, and they want to do well, but, you know, they're happy to finish. They're happy to get that belt buckle and say, you know what, I did the Iditarod, and it's made me a better dog driver, made me a better musher, made me a better man, woman, whatever. But I honor all of them. I give a tremendous amount of respect for everybody that is doing this, whether ultra competitive or the little guy with just a little team of dogs and you know, on the property. So go for it, all of you. So Jason, how do you want to end your coverage of Iditarod on Mush U Huskies?
Well, I want to end it with thanking everybody for being a part of this. All of you who have listened to the show, done the downloaded it either live or downloaded it, who've joined our blogs, who've commented to me both personally and on Facebook, and sent me personal messages and emails privately. I just want to thank all of you and assure you that if you stick with me, if you stick with us, you know, we're going to keep giving you good coverage. Is that even though I think our Iditarod coverage is coming to an end, this is just the end of 1 year, and we're basically going to go right to work building up for 2012, not just the Iditarod, but all different races. So I just want to wish you all well, and hope you enjoyed our coverage, and thanks for listening to it.
Thank you very much, Jason. Take care of everything that's going on back in Montana. Hope to meet you soon, okay?
Okay, thank you for having me, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Michelle,
anything you would like to add?
Yeah, I think that I am going to challenge the two of you to keep this going. I think that we should do a Mush U Huskies at least once a month in the off season. Talk about strategy, talk about dog yard duties, talk about training and things like that, because I think a lot of the fans don't want to just hear about the race. I think they want to hear about that kind of stuff, and I'm not talking about picking up the poop. I'm talking about feeding and things like that.
But I'm
so
good at picking up the poop. That's one of my main. That's one of my talents.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I'm just teaching Robert how to pick up the poop, Jason.
Well, we'll do our best to keep it going. Of course, during the off season, we do talk a lot about musher history and, you know, the different dogs and things at races. So we do have quite a following as we go. So we'll see what we can do. Like Jason just said, it's not just about the Iditarod. It is the sport in general. And of course, the Iditarod is the showcase event for the sport. So thank you very much, guys. We're out of time. We're no longer live. We will talk again soon, okay?
Thank you for having me on, both of you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Goodbye.